We're discussing what happened to job growth in states that ended the enhanced federal unemployment benefits early versus states like Wisconsin that kept the extra benefits until they expired yesterday. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. About two dozen states chose to end the $300 weekly extra federal unemployment aid early back in June. Economists from Columbia, Harvard, other universities, they used banking data to measure the effects in a new study. Have you collected unemployment benefits in the pandemic? How have the expanded benefits helped you? Have you delayed looking for work due to the weekly unemployment bonus? 800-642-1234 to join in. Kyle Coombs is an economics doctoral candidate at Columbia University, one of the study authors. Kyle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. So you and your colleagues dug into this data comparing 22 states that ended the expanded unemployment benefits early with those that kept them in place. Did states that ended benefits early create more jobs?
What we saw in our data was we were looking at individuals at bank transaction data, and we saw states that ended jobs states that ended the unemployment expansion saw 4.4 percentage points more jobs. Now, to put that in perspective, because that's not a super helpful number, sort of mechanically, because they ended the benefits, they saw 35 percentage points fewer people getting unemployment insurance. And so what that number comes out to is 1 in 8. So for every 8 people who lost benefits because of this policy move, we saw only one get a job through August 6th when we were looking.
So one get a job through August 6th. What were the ramifications to the larger economy in those states?
Sure. So we also can see their spending behavior and their income and break out income by earnings from a job and unemployment insurance receipt. So we saw, you know, on average, 278 drop in unemployment insurance to these households, and then an increase on average of $14 in earnings. So that's a big gap. And then, so what do you do when you have that sort of net fall in income? You look for ways to cut your spending. And so the households in our sample, which our sample is predominantly lower income and credit constrained households, that translates to $145 less on average of spending. They're spending that much less money. So that there's sort of two ways to think about that. Usually these households we think would be spending $700 to $750. So that's a 20% drop in their weekly spending. That's tough on any household budget, especially the ones in our sample. And then sort of for the wider economy, that comes out to for every dollar less in income coming into these households, they reduce spending 50 cents. So there's just that much less money floating around in the economy going around to businesses.
And your sample size, it was about 18,600 earn-in users. And this is, earn-in is a company that offers customers advances on their paychecks. And is that right?
Yeah. So earn-in is it's a financial app platform that offers people advances on their paychecks during the pandemic. They've had to change their business model a little bit, but that's the idea. For people working, they give them sort of a chance to get a little bit of money early to help them smooth out their spending. Because when you're on a biweekly pay schedule or a monthly or something, that can be very difficult. And so through a data partnership, which was really invaluable for doing a lot of different work the group Opportunity Insights has been leading, exploring employment outcomes and unemployment outcomes during the pandemic. Earn-in gave us access to their bank transaction data. And we focused on anyone who was unemployed and insured in the last week of April. Okay. The reason we went with that is in the first week of May, you saw governors and states start to say, okay, in June, we're going to cut benefits. And so we figured, okay, if we look at anyone after that announcement was made, maybe they've already started to make plans, change mm-hmm. what they're doing in response to the announcement. We want to look at people who, you know, are likely to be affected and have this policy make a difference in their lives, not be responding to it, because we were looking to identify a causal effect of the policy change, because that's what we think is most useful.
Kyle Coombs is with us, economics doctoral candidate at Columbia. He and his colleagues examined job growth in states that ended federal unemployment aid early. We're looking at the upshot of the study. With your thoughts as well, have you collected unemployment benefits in the pandemic? How have the expanded benefits helped you? Have you delayed looking for work due to the benefits? What incentives would prompt you to look for work? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. The enhanced benefits, Kyle, provided out-of-work people an extra $600 from the federal government during 2020. This year, the federal government has paid an extra $300 weekly. Republicans, they've been saying this extra money is keeping people from looking for jobs. Here's State Senator Howard Markline talking to WPR in May.
When you pay people more to stay home, they stay home.
Is there something to that he's saying there, that they stay home due to these benefits?
So based on our results, it would suggest that's not a huge part of it. Mm. Especially when, so we see this, you know, 1 in 8 who went back and got a job. And we're looking, you know, 6 weeks after, 5 to 6 weeks after these cuts happened. You know, that the benefits, this expansion of $300, or for some people, their eligibility for unemployment in general was taken away. So they didn't just lose $300, they lost all their unemployment insurance. Mm-hmm. We see this uptick. The uptick, that 4.4 percentage points number, past studies of unemployment insurance sort of suggest that would make sense. So what you do in the past is you say when people hit the 26th limit, sort of standard unemployment duration that people can draw benefits for, typically after that you do see people go back to work a little in small numbers around this number we estimated. So if you had known nothing else about what was happening in the world, mm-hmm. And just knew those results, heard there was a big amount of unemployment expansion and then they're taking it away, how many people do you think are going back to work? Some would say, oh, yeah, probably about, you know, in the this single digits percentage, probably what people do if they've been unemployed for a while. So we said, all right, it would be unusual if we saw no effect, but, you know, there's credence to the fact that this is a huge expansion, mm-hmm. And this time could be different. And people can tell a lot of different stories. Obviously, there's partisan arguing about it, but, you know, ultimately, the question is an empirical question. Mm-hmm. And so with the right policy variation and data, which we had both of those things, you can really look down at the individual decisions that get made when these policies get changed. And we have some ideas about what else might be going on that go beyond just you're receiving money from the government and that's making you choose to stay home. We think there's a lot of other factors at play right now.
Well, I want to look at those other factors, but I want to ask you this about the data. Do you mm-hmm. think this data alone is representative enough, that it's accurate enough to draw inferences on the workforce as a whole for what happened to the job market in these states?
Sure. One important thing to note, and thank you for bringing that up, about our sample is it's a lower income and credit constrained group. So if anything, these numbers we estimated are probably on the upper end. If you're lower income and you don't have a lot of savings to draw on, if mm-hmm. you lose $300 a week or however much you were getting in unemployment insurance, you don't have money that you can just dig into
You don't have a reserve.
Yeah, you just don't have a reserve. So you really need to get back to work. So we think that number may be on the higher end. On this, by the same token, that drop of about 20% of household spending is also probably on the higher end. And that there have been studies in the past, we were definitely on the higher end of that, what people would expect. And that's, again, because these households don't have as much of a savings cushion to fall back on. So in both senses, in both directions, we're probably overestimating, but certainly on the employment side, we think that we've probably got an overestimate of, mm-hmm. of how much people go back to work. We do try to, we tried to extrapolate out and say, you know, what would that mean for the larger economy? Just let's wave our hands, say, you know, assume everybody does work the same way as the people on our sample. Just what does that look like? What does that mean for the larger economy? So we saw in April, we had 2.9 million people receiving unemployment insurance in the states we were looking at. 2 million of them just lost the jobless benefits entirely in June. 1 million just lost $300. That our numbers would, if you just sort of take the proportion of that, the 4.4% proportion, that's mm-hmm. about 145,000 additional jobs. And that is an increase in jobs. There are some caveats to a number like that. One of them being, again, that we're probably giving an upper estimate. Yeah. Another being, you know, aggregate demand probably fell. People were spending less in these economies. We found that. So maybe there needed to be fewer jobs. The businesses basically hired less because they were having less economic activity happening. That's really, we can't capture that explicitly.
Well, let's pause right there with Columbia University economist Kyle Coombs, lead author on a study last month comparing the impact of states that eliminated enhanced unemployment benefits with states that kept them in place. How do you think the expanded federal benefits affected our economy? Were they necessary to help us through the pandemic, or have they made labor too expensive? Join in your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We'll talk more in a minute with Kyle Coombs here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring what happened to job growth in states that ended enhanced federal unemployment insurance payments early, ahead of the nationwide expiration yesterday on Labor Day. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was a critic of the $300 a week pandemic benefits in session in July. Here he is trying to end them with fellow Republicans.
You're just going to wait for a check in the mail. That is the Democrat playbook and what they want the future of Wisconsin to be. Waiting for your next handout from the government, because then you'll vote for the politicians who will give it to you.
Was the federal aid a hand up or hand out? Are you a business owner? Have you been able to find workers? How have the expanded unemployment benefits affected your business? Join in 800-642-1234. Kyle Coombs is an economics doctoral student at Columbia University, co-authored the study on the states that ended aid early, and stays with us. Kyle, you kind of took a hint there at other factors at play, and wondering if you could speculate for us. If it wasn't the extra cash that kept people from looking for work, what was it?
Sure. So there are a few different things. It could be one of the lead off. So we have three hypotheses I'm going to name here. The lead off one would be people are still worried about COVID. And that plays in a way that wouldn't in normal economic times. Especially, again, in a lot of jobs that are forward facing, it's a concerning place to go back to work. So that's sort of the first and maybe most immediate to think about. The second would be childcare, especially ending the benefits over the summer, and then now leading into the school year. Summer camps likely weren't open in a lot of places, and schools, it's, you know, school districts, summer opening, summer mm-hmm. opening, and then having to close, it makes for a much less flexible work schedule that someone can offer, since if they have children. And so that can create issues. Your kids come first, for families. And so balancing that is a lot more challenging.
And certainly the cost of childcare as well.
The cost of childcare is very high. Yeah. And then, the third would be, if you look at the current population survey, you'll see they ask folks, are you happy in the work you've been doing? And there's a much higher proportion of people answering that survey saying, no, I want to switch industries, or I want to go back to what I was working in. And so if that's sincere, and folks are willing to take some time, take a little bit of a, like not earn some money for a little while so that they can get to a different industry where they think they'll be happier, that'll take longer for the economy to re-equilibrate. For folks to find a new place to work. That's not just going back to where you were working, or maybe you have a network of friends who all worked in this industry, and you're a server who worked at one restaurant, and then you don't want to go back there, or they don't have room for you, but you have friends who are servers other places, so you can go back to there. If you don't want to be a server anymore and you want to go start working as a fitness trainer, just arbitrary examples mm-hmm. here. That's, you don't have that network in place. That's maybe you need to train to get to that. Obviously you need to train to be a fitness trainer, I suppose. Yeah. But
there are more complications there in order not to just settle, not to just go back to doing what you were doing.
Exactly. So those three factors, COVID, childcare, and switching industries, are three leading ideas. That there could be others, but we're now working on trying to unpack those and figure out what's happening.
We're talking with Kyle Coombs, who is an economics doctoral candidate at Columbia. A new report looked at 22 states that ended the federal unemployment weekly benefits early. Let's bring in John now in Eau Claire. Hi, John. What are your thoughts on the benefits?
Well, I can't speak to any state. I can't speak to the state of Wisconsin, but I can tell you that in the Chippewa Valley, almost everyone I know could name a person or two who have collected these benefits in lieu of working. And what's happening is that people's decision-making is not based upon economic necessity, but rather than on the smug notion that I shouldn't have to work until I find a job I like. And that's antithetical to our capitalist and free enterprise system.
John, thanks. And does that, Kyle, relate at all to your number three there?
Mm-hmm. So it does. And I think there it has to do, I take the point that, folks wanting to wait may run against values. Coming from sort of this economic modeling point of view, I think it's pretty clear when there are good matches between workers and jobs, the economy performs more healthfully. If it's a good match between an employer and a worker, then they can be more productive together, and it's less likely that there will be a separation down the line. Because the worker wants to work in that job and the employer wants that worker. So it's counterintuitive, but it's, and frustrating to no end what's happening. The labor shortage is certainly frustrating. It doesn't feel to me as clear cut, that you want people, to just take the first job that shows up.
Yeah. So what happens next for this project, Kyle? Now that these benefits have expired for all states, what are you working on?
We're working on a few different things. One of the first things is we're looking for congestion. Congestion in the labor market is... we estimate this 4.4 percentage point number. When you have a lot of people all trying to go back and get a job at once, as probably happened. So a bunch of people, you know, if it was the benefits holding them back and they all tried to go look for work in that scenario, then you would see people who hadn't been getting benefits have a tougher time to find jobs. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking to see if there's evidence that actually, while some got jobs, others who weren't incentivized by benefits, maybe they got fewer jobs. So we're looking to see if there's an effect there.
Kyle, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Kyle Coombs of Columbia University co-authored the study called Early Withdrawal of Pandemic Unemployment Insurance Effects on Earnings, Employment, and Consumption. We have a link to it at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we look at the shape of U.S. immigration policy over the decades. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the history, the politics, the culture of air conditioning here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. An analyst from J.P. Morgan said this week that air conditioning makers are in a golden era. Demand for new and replacement AC units has been strong since the financial crisis a decade ago. And there are other reasons to be bullish for those analysts as many developing countries start plugging into AC. Do you live without air conditioning either at home or at work? How do you manage? What strategies do you take to stay cool on weeks like this? Do you think the air is too cool at your work or public places? And have you heard or been part of the office temperature debate? We're at 800-642-1234. Penelope Green is a feature writer in the style department of the New York Times. Her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? Penelope, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you looked over 100 years ago to the beginning of this technology. Why do we have air conditioning?
Well, we have air conditioning because a junior engineer at a printing plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, figured out a way to blow air over water and reduce the humidity in this printing plant that was gumming up the pages of a humor magazine that was being printed. For millennia, there have been some sort of cooling, mechanical or otherwise, and this really revolutionized it and made it possible to do it more efficiently and put it out there.
And when did we see air conditioning take off? How did it rise in popularity?
Well, they refined the systems and refined the systems. And by the 30s in the White House, there was central air conditioning. And by mid-century in this country, at least, electricity was cheap enough and the technology was good enough that it was in most homes. And, you know, we know it changed manufacturing and it allowed huge areas of the country to be developed. Florida, Houston, the Sun Belt, Singapore, globally, it's called the Air Conditioned Nation. I can give you some fun facts about air conditioning in the White House if you're interested.
Yeah, something about President Nixon.
Well, it was President Nixon loved it, loved the air conditioning to be turned down so low that he could turn on the fire, have a fire in the summer. And Lyndon Johnson similarly liked it so low he wanted to sleep with an electric blanket over him in the summer.
You also write that without air conditioning, we'd have no internet because server farms get really hot and they depend on air.
Yes, absolutely. There would be many, many, many industries that would not exist or be possible without air conditioning.
And almost 90% of American homes have air conditioning. Is there any evidence that all this temperature regulation is altering our behaviors or our lifestyles?
Well, I mean, there have been surveys, global surveys done that have shown that those who are in sort of less developed countries have a greater comfort with temperature variability. But I think that, you know, on balance, it's altered our lifestyle for the good. I don't think anybody suggests that we should do away with air conditioning.
Help us understand building efficiency standards. Why do we have them and how is air conditioning involved?
Well, many states, including New York, have put laws into place that require that will reduce the carbon emissions of the buildings, which are big, big producers, polluters. And in New York State, the benchmark is to reduce carbon emissions by 85% by the year 2050. And air conditioning is a factor. It uses a lot of energy. Interestingly enough, it does not use as much energy across the country as heating does. We use four times more energy to heat our homes and our workplaces than we do to cool them. But the way air conditioning fits into this, again, it's a big energy load, and buildings will be built to these standards that just make them more efficient with better insulation, green roofs, delivering the energy to cool and to heat the spaces with renewables like solar.
When I think of air conditioning, in my youth, I think of the window unit that was hauled down from the attic, put into the window, and then turned on. How have window units impacted efficiency?
Well, not being an HVAC engineer or any engineer of any kind at all, I can tell you that window units get better, but just on balance, they're less efficient from an energy standpoint than central air.
Penelope Green is a feature writer in the Style Department of the New York Times, and her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? It's a question that might get a resounding yes, given this week's temperatures. Are you curious about the invention and expansion of air conditioning? Are you concerned we've become too dependent on AC? Do you try to cut back on using it in your own life? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can also email your thoughts on AC to ideas@wpr.org. Penelope, in what ways do we overconsume air conditioning? Where do we go overboard?
Well, I think that, again, not being an energy expert, I think that in terms of the experience of people in offices, office workers, many of whom are women, will complain that the AC is just too darn high, and they're freezing in their offices. So I think that that's where the debate comes in, at least in New York City. There's lots of back and forth about the space being engineered or cooled to the thermal comfort of men in suits, and there can be charges every summer that, you know, it's a sexist gendered temperature, and there's lots of debate on Twitter about that.
Is there merit to that claim that temperatures are adjusted for male employees?
There really isn't. I mean, not in my, you know, very cursory reporting. Our building on 41st Street is cooled to what are known as just an industry standard of 76 degrees. And the building is built with the AC in its floors, and we have ductwork or fans rather at every single desk, and employees are able to sort of open that vent or close that vent in an effort to kind of customize their space. And again, in a sort of anecdotal survey of buildings around the city, most buildings are set to that temperature. The standard by an organization called ASHRAE really asks that building facilities directors alter the temperature of the building or make the temperature of the building something that's comfortable for 80% of the occupants. And that means that 20% of staffers are going to be uncomfortable or miserable.
Yeah.
Too cold or too hot.
And your piece kind of reignited this debate about air conditioning, especially on social media. What was the internet response to your article? What did people say?
Well, my Twitter feed lit up with a lot of women tweeting that they were freezing in their offices, and it lit up with a lot of men being enraged that anybody suggests that office temperatures were too high or too low. Mm-hmm. It was quite funny.
Let's go to Owen now and Weawega. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hello. I had to shut off the radio there, and I think AC makes us lazy. I'm on the farm, and I actually wear long-sleeve shirts all summer long. Not so much for UV protection, but just because I actually find that that kind of air conditions me, because I get covered in perspiration, and the cotton shirts kind of keep the moist moisture around your body so it doesn't evaporate so quickly, and that actually keeps me cooler. But my wife, Lisa, she sleeps in the room with the AC and the window unit, and I sleep in the living room because I find if I sleep in the AC, when I wake up, we get up at 3, we're outside by a little after 3, I even find it's 10 times hotter if I spend the night in that AC room.
Oh, because your body temperature is adjusted to the room that is air-conditioned.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, even when I'm in my truck, I do the same thing. I'll turn the AC on sometimes just to so I can see out the windshield because it has an air dryer. You know, your AC actually dries the air and takes some of the moisture out of the air, which helps when you need to see, but I always roll the windows down at the same time because I don't want to become spoiled and feeling like I'm not climatized to the outside temperature. I grew up with no AC. My father and mother, I'm 40, my father and mother always said that we didn't need AC in Vermont because we only had 3 months out of the year when it wasn't, you know, below 65 degrees anyway. And in the wintertime, we tried so hard to keep it at 62 degrees or you know, in that range. So why would we fight to keep it at a different temperature and spend more money on energy during the summer?
Owen, thank you so much for describing your story. Penelope, you know, Owen's saying, look, air conditioning makes people kind of lazy.
Well, I think that, you know, many would agree with him, and there are studies that have been done, again, that show we, you know, we're so adaptable as humans, and we get used to certain things. That said, I think that nobody would want a manufacturing plant or an assembly line to not be air-conditioned, but certainly in one's home, you can, you know, you can make yourself. You know, I'm a Northeasterner, and you know, we do try and keep our thermostats low in the winter for energy reasons. And you can get used to temperature swings if you really work on it.
Penelope Green is with us. She is a feature writer at the New York Times, and she's been writing about air conditioning. Are you concerned we've become too dependent on it? Are you concerned about the energy use and the climate change impact of all this air conditioning? Do you try to minimize your AC for that reason? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. When the summer heat wave arrives, so does this long-standing debate over the thermostat. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Should the air be cranked up? Should there be throw blankets around the office? The U.S. and China account for over half of the world's air conditioners. According to the International Energy Agency, the number of AC units installed globally is set to jump from about 1.6 billion today to 5.6 billion in about 3 decades from now. Do you live without air conditioning, either at home or work? How do you manage? What strategies do you take to stay cool on weeks like this? Are you concerned our world is becoming too dependent on AC? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. And Penelope Green stays with us. She is a feature writer at the New York Times. Penelope, through your reporting, you interviewed an architecture firm that in 2015 designed its workspace without the convenience of air conditioning. What did you find there?
Oh, this was a wonderful, wonderful experiment. The company is called Kieran Timberlake, and they have 100 employees, and they are a design-forward company trying to sort of figure out how to minimize their impact and the impact of their work from an energy standpoint. And they renovated a former bottling plant, which was made of concrete and steel.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. And it was built at mid-century. And they decided to do this renovation with you know, the lowest sort of energy impact possible. And they designed the place with passive house technologies. And those are sort of principles. It's a German standard. The idea is to maintain a steady interior climate by making the building envelope pre-airtight and install a system, you know, mostly fans and things like that, to exchange the indoor and the outdoor air. And passive house principles usually mean that you could reduce your energy impact by about 60 to 80%. So they put in mechanical ventilation, that means fans, natural ventilation, that means windows that open, automatic shades to shade the building during the, you know, from the hot sun, it was very, very well insulated, thick concrete slab floor, and dehumidifiers. And the idea is to you know, basically regulate the temperature the way buildings have regulated temperature for thousands of years, like a Roman villa, you know, shading the place against the hot summer sun during the day and then opening up at night to flush out the hot air. And it was complicated. The first summer they opened, the staffers were miserable, and they were surveyed sort of at all points during the day, and basically, you know, and they tried all sorts of things. They tried, you know, working early in the morning when the heat wasn't that great, changing the dress code. People could come to work in shorts.
The employees said they were melting.
They were melting. They really were. And they brought in, you know, fans for the desks and more floor fans. And finally, they just realized that, you know, too many of their staffers were miserable. So they switched to what's known as a mixed mode operation. They brought in conventional air conditioning, but used it sparingly. And that's how the place runs now. And it's a good model for other buildings.
What should we take away from this experience? What did work?
Well, there are two things to take away. One is just the climate in Philadelphia, and maybe that building in particular. Passive house technology without conventional cooling, I mean, most passive house building has some kind of cooling in it, but passive house, it works best in places with big diurnal temperature swings like the desert. You could probably do it in the desert where it gets quite cold at night without any conventional cooling at all. But in most places, you do need some air conditioning system. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is they developed a survey technique, a cloud-based app called Roast, and they just, you know, they surveyed their employees constantly, and it helped them refine.
I'm sorry, I'm just laughing at the name of that app. I mean,
I know it's great.
Oh dear. So they really had to keep an eye on their employees because they don't want their employees to leave them over the temperature. I mean, for goodness sake.
Exactly. And here's another really important thing about that experiment. 41% of Karen Timberlake's employees at the time were female. And so one wondered and one asked, you know, were the respondents who were most miserable men? And in fact, it was not the case that that there was a gendered response to the heat. Everybody was pretty miserable. They did learn, however, that more women responded to the survey questions than men.
Let's take another call now. Larry is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. First of all, I was raised on a farm in central Wisconsin. No air conditioning. You'd work out in the field all day, and you'd sleep at night and sweating. But anyway, every factory that I worked in except for one didn't have air conditioning in it. I don't know where she's getting this that factories have air conditioning in it. I worked in a tractor manufacturer. I worked in an outboard manufacturer in different various job shops, and only one of those had air conditioning in it. So I don't know where you're getting this that most factories have air conditioning in them nowadays.
What does the factories you've been in and worked in, Larry, what do they feel like in the summer?
Well, they're hot, but I mean, it's the same thing as in a few degrees warmer than what it is outside, but you struggle through the day. I mean, it's I guess it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You either want the job or you don't. And, you know, that's just my thought. I mean, like I said, on the farm, nowadays, yes, the tractors have air conditioning, but back in the old days, you wanted to stay cool, you put a fan, umbrella over the seat, and you at least got shaded. I mean, it is what it is. I think, like the other farmer said, we've gotten soft.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Penelope, I mean, if you want the work in the factory, you go to the work, regardless of the temperature.
It is the case that fans which electric fans came into play in a widespread way at the same time that our friend in Williamsburg invented what would become the conventional air conditioner. Fans have altered manufacturing as well, and it also may be the case that there are regional differences that companies and industries further south may have to deploy air conditioning. And in places like yours, where the temperatures aren't quite so brutal, it might be possible to live without it.
Well, let's fit in one more call here. Justin in Madison. Hi, Justin. Nope, Justin is not there. Penelope, climate change is only going to make our world warmer. What can we expect for the future of air conditioning?
I just think that it will get more efficient and buildings will get more efficient. Certainly in this country, many, many states have enacted similar laws to the ones that we have here in New York City and in New York State to curtail the carbon emissions of new buildings and retrofit older ones, commercial spaces, that is. So I think there's a lot of hope in ingenuity.
Although at the same time, around the world, countries are, basically plugging into air conditioning, China being the other biggest user of air conditioners. How do we see other places around the world changing their perspective on air conditioning?
Well, I think that as countries grow richer and they can afford it, they're going to clamor for it. You noted some statistics about that. We can only hope that climate change agreements like the Paris Accord will be taken up by developing nations and they'll do the right thing.
Penelope, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Penelope Green is a feature writer in the Style Department of the New York Times. Her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? And we have a link to it on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.